another handout is a replacement page for the last page of the syllabus, because you need this one too. Because I have no less than 3 different dates listed for the due date for your, if you're opting to do the web version of your project, not your proposal, but your project presentation. So between that and also leaving out 1 short reading on the last week that I forgot to put in, and then I wanted to give you on the back some suggestions for additional reading, may or may not help you in your research projects, because I expect your research projects to be quite artifact specific. You may not find stuff in necessarily in these readings on your artifacts, but if you want more information about classic works in the Sir Lord Gellier, or particularly some recent work, and if you can stay as it is, there's some good suggestions there for library reading. The third, any questions on the syllabus? So take the syllabus, rip off the last page, and replace it with this one. Okay? It's the corrected version. There are 3 handouts. You need them. The third one, you're probably most with at the moment, and these are guidelines for your project proposals, which are due a week from Wednesday. So they are due May 30th. It tried to make it pretty clear what I expect. Basically, I expect a 1-page outline. Just tell me what topic you settled on, what kind of artifact, what basic questions you're interested in, and what methodologies you're going to use. And based on that, I might be able to give you some suggestions for reading a resource. I expect that some of your research questions or methodologies may change as you start to work on it. That's okay, but I want you at this stage to start thinking about it, because the end of the term will come before you know it. We're almost at the halfway point already. Okay? And I do want you to settle on your artifact of choice. Not much. You should get decided by next week. Any questions on this? Did you notice the article? Did you author this article, the one that got passed around?
I'm sorry?
Look at the article, it's the author's name. You're famous, and you didn't know it, huh? Comments. She's not here though, huh?
The reading commentaries that you guys have been emailing is really good, so I'm optimistic that we'll have more lively discussion today. And thank you, the leaders taking the initiative of putting questions in front of people ahead of time. I think that's also a great idea. On reading commentaries, just a reminder, most of them did this, but just in case yours didn't, be sure in your reading commentaries that you're making a reference to the readings that you did themselves. I mean, it's wonderful to bring in outside experiences and knowledges, but be sure that part of the purpose of the reading commentaries is to demonstrate that you have done the readings. So make sure you kind of relate them back to the readings, okay? Mandy and Latoya, there's some handouts you want to get at break. And what else did I have for announcements? After break, I'll pass out a sign-up sheet for Greenfield Village. Please remind me if I am doing that right at the beginning. I'm still not entirely certain we have a final headcount. I need to get that to get the funding together. I think that's it for announcements. Heavy day of announcements. Someone is hoarding extra final pages of the syllabus someplace. Any other questions or announcements? News, okay. In terms of lecture, I have two discrete things I want to do today, and I hope hopefully I can get through it. I think I can. Number one is if you're following the syllabus, you were kind of behind on one discussion/lecture topic, which was to talk about 18th century life, particularly urban life. As part of what we're doing in the class is looking at, you know, theoretical methodological issues about artifact analysis, material cultures, and looking at generally the development of the subfield of historical archaeology. But we're also doing this going historically and trying to understand what's going on in American material culture through the centuries and what kind of transformations are occurring leading up to our quote-unquote modern era. along with the Cliff Notes version of U.S. history, which hopefully most of you don't need. It's just a little bit of an overview to kind of put our material cultural studies in some sort of historical chronological context. So what I want to do is to kind of pick up where Dietz left off with the late 18th century, the period of the revolution. In the mid-18th century, colonial towns started to really started to be transformed into cities. And this was in part because of a population increase that was happening across the nation, and in part because of economics and certain changes that were occurring in the colonial economy. And it is a process, this urbanization process, that led to the American Industrial Revolution, as well as significant changes in everyday life and material life. You need to remember that before the revolution, only 5% of the American colonial population, North American colonial population, to be the United States in the future, only 5% of the population lived in cities. The vast majority of the country lived in rural settings, and possibly villages or hamlets. But this would change rapidly over the next several decades, about 1760s forward. So, and you see a number of trends beginning in the 1760s in cities such as Boston, New Orleans, Philadelphia, Charleston, New York. These were cities, or these were towns that really became cities in this late colonial period. You see, number one, population growth. Two, an increase in ethnic diversity. Three, increased importance of these cities to regional trade and regional government. There's a kind of a centralization going on of economic power as well as political power. Number four, you see in these cities the creation, for the first time really, of an urban elite. And this urban elite started to purchase food and clothing not only from abroad, but also started purchasing it from other colonists. And this leads to a whole new wave of domestic manufacturers, which Dietz does begin to talk about, but in his earlier period, in that Americanization period, this really had to do with development of regional folk cultures. Well, in the later period, it really starts to conform to elite urban tastes and to really supply this kind of cosmopolitan culture that's developing. Number five, you see you see rising levels of consumption for all classes. And this means kind of two things. It means, when you talk about consumption, it means people are buying more of their goods rather than making it themselves or bartering with neighbors. So they're using a cash economy to purchase goods made elsewhere, usually. And it just means simply an increase in the amount of goods that are going into their everyday lives. But overall, despite this kind of emergence of an urban elite and rising levels of consumption for everyone, at the same time, you're also getting, number six, an increase in the stratification of classes. You know what I mean by stratification? No? You want to?
Just like the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Yeah.
Level between the rich.
Right. Greater differences between different socioeconomic classes. The poorer, poorer, the richer, richer. Middle might be more middle. A larger gulf, more significant differences. Okay. Any questions on these kind of urbanization trends in this late colonial period? This is really starting in the 1760s and continues into the early 19th century, until you really get the identifiable beginnings of the American Industrial Revolution. It's kind of the precursor social and economic conditions that are going to lead to an American
conversion of the Industrial Revolution. By the way, where does classically, where do historians talk about the Industrial Revolution beginning? What do I mean by the Industrial Revolution? I mean, that's a fair question. I could mean many different things.
These machines.
What?
These machines for production.
The use of machines for mass production, yeah.
Did it start in Europe, like in England or something?
Yeah. It's classically, most classically identified with what would be antebellum England, but really we'll talk about early 19th century England. The beginning of what we would identify as machine-generated, mass-produced manufacturing. Is anyone the use of capital, particularly to invest in machinery and complicated manufacturing processes? Okay. Starts to be a greater dependence on machine labor than human labor. All right. What I would like to do is then kind of bring these historic trends down to a more local level and talk about four example cities and some things that were happening on the ground in daily life there. My first example is Philadelphia. In the 1760s, just to give you an idea of ethnic diversity and to remind you about also the context of slavery, which we'll talk about on Wednesday, 1/5 of Philadelphia's population was enslaved in 1760s. And at this time, Philadelphia was not only the largest city in North America, it was the largest city of all the British colonies. It was the megapolis, as Ken Asher liked to talk about. It had a population in 1770 of 35,000, which doesn't sound like very much now, right? What's the population of Ann Arbor?
110,000.
Yeah, somewhere 100 teens, I think. So it was approximately one third, maybe even 1/4 the size of Ann Arbor, but it was the largest city in the British colonies. Commerce grew quickly once things started to be centralized in through Philadelphia, particularly in iron and textiles. Those were two areas of kind of the American Industrial Revolution that kind of had their beginnings in Philadelphia. I mean, textiles are obviously important also in Massachusetts, in New England, but Philadelphia, they're important to the kind of explosive growth of Philadelphia. And there are two things that we see especially clearly socially is the trend in stratification that I talked about. In Philadelphia, historians have calculated, looking at economic figures, that a male laborer, someone who maybe laid bricks or plastered houses, dug ditches, something like that, a male laborer could not support a family, could not support, say, give a house and food to a wife and children. It simply was not possible in late century Philadelphia. So as a result, women and children were employed. They either worked jobs, sold goods on the street, perhaps the woman took in some piecework sewing to do. So at the lower levels, all members of the family were involved in production or working in some fashion. On the other hand, you do see one of the other trends very clearly in Philadelphia. And that is the elites of Philadelphia, as the elites of the largest, and at this time most cosmopolitan town in the British colonies, really started to create a culture of their own, and to really start to define what it meant to be an American elite. They did participate in what Dietz starts to identify as kind of Anglophilia, the love of all things English. And
Remember, this is where Georgian architecture comes from. If you look at Philadelphia colonial townhouses, they're kind of a miniature, squished, urban version of Georgian architecture. They're very symmetrical, very clean. They have very simple Greco-Roman elements to them. And this Georgian architecture is really an imitation of country houses of the aristocracy in 18th century England. But they get transformed in Philadelphia to those classic narrow townhouses. Anyone know what I'm thinking of in Philadelphia? Part of this Anglophilia also meant that the elites were really interested in imports coming from England through the river system. Philadelphia was a port city of sorts, supported by its river port. And their colonial merchants, doctors, lawyers, tried to emulate British upper classes, not only through their architecture, but through concerts, plays, dance, dress fashion. And they also filled their houses with fine furniture. However, as much as they had pretensions towards emulating the British aristocracy, they didn't really quite have the resources, particularly once you start importing things that greatly increase the cost. You have to add transportation costs as well as duties. So what they started to do was to give support to and to start ordering copies of British-type elite furniture, in particular, to local American craftsmen. And they were known, and as a result, Philadelphia artisans became particularly known for producing magnificent copies of works of Thomas Chippendale, which many of you may have heard about, Great Britain's most famous furniture designer. And the name Chippendale is so associated with U.S. artisans right now, you may not realize that the original Chippendale was actually British, because now there's a widespread American furniture style called American Chippendale. It has nothing to do with the dancers that I'm aware of. Maybe if someone wants to research this and let me know if there's any connection. But if you watch like the Antiques Roadshow or something like that, they'll often talk about Chippendale style furniture and trying to authenticate. And a lot of the authentication goes back to identifying either British examples from the original Thomas Chippendale, but more likely some well-known Philadelphia craftsmen who were carriers of this Chippendale style. So this combined with some folk elements in furniture design, because the craftsmen who were producing it weren't necessarily coming out of this British tradition. They may have been in the colonies for a number of generations already. And eventually the style, much as the gravestone styles that Dietz identified, changed through a combination of urban popular culture. And this would be an example of popular culture, right? Because it's being imported into an urban center and diffusing from there, right? But in this case, one thing that happened was this popular American Chippendale furniture design melded with some folk designs to become identifiably American Chippendale, such that connoisseurs can tell the difference with one look, whether it's a British Chippendale or an American Chippendale. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Yes, no. Anyone want to describe what a classic, like a Chippendale mirror? There are lots of mirrors in particular that are used.
It's still used for furniture, sort of, but it's so just used because of the name, but you don't really know what it originally was like. In all furniture catalogs now, like every designer has something called a Chippendale.
Yeah. I could try to bring in some books for pictures of this. Classic Chippendale mirror might be oval-shaped, gilded with a lot of circular facets. And And what's classic for the American Chippendale is you would put an eagle at the top, an eagle design. And particularly after the Revolution, right? Because the eagle was one of the symbolic representations of liberty. So that was one example in which this originally British poplar style got transformed into something American, became quintessentially American. A lot of people identify with Chippendale furniture. Somehow very, very, very root American. All right, move on to my next example, Williamsburg. Williamsburg was kind of a southern capital city in many ways. It was made the capital of Virginia in 1699. And in another kind of fit of Anglophilia, it was renamed from, it used to be called Middleburg, got renamed Williamsburg in honor of William III of England. Not that important, just a little trivia there. And it subsequently became a social and cultural center, and it was especially notable for political debates held in the House of Burgesses there, preceding the American Revolution. In terms of, if you think about the American Revolution and the kind of coalescence of political action and political life in America, it had three basic centers: Williamsburg, Philadelphia, and in a more kind of chaotic state in Boston. I say chaotic because it was more kind of on the streets, the popular movements in Boston. But in Philadelphia and Williamsburg, it was happening in the local colonial representative bodies. It was called the House of Burgesses in Virginia. In Philadelphia, I'm not sure, it might be called the Colonial Congress. And what's interesting about Williamsburg is, who here has been to Williamsburg? You know what I'm talking about? You know, this is like the second most visited tourist site in all of the United States, and only two of you have been. After what? What's number one? No. No. Grand Canyon. It's Grand Canyon, Williamsburg, and then maybe Disneyland in New York, something like that. And you guys have never heard of Williamsburg. How many people? I really want to know this, because how many people have never heard of Williamsburg? What is Colonial Williamsburg? What is it?
Like a park?
Or
like
a resort or something?
Resort? They have like...
What's it look like?
Yeah. Okay, like a reenactment.
And what?
They have like a town set up.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right,
you can go and like, walk through.
Right. It's a reconstructed historic town, and it's on the original site of Williamsburg, and it's kind of frozen in time around the period of the Revolution. And architecturally, what's interesting about what's going on there is there's kind of, whereas in Philadelphia you see a real kind of bifurcation in styles and housing, particularly the elites are getting these huge mansions in one part of town, whereas the laborers and people who work on the in the shipyards are living in another part of town in these very dense tenements. In Williamsburg, everyone has some little Georgian piece of architecture. And if you look at, if you visit Williamsburg, you'll kind of be struck because all of the buildings are reconstructed in Georgian style. I mean, down to outhouses being in Georgian style, having perfect symmetry. And they do vary between brick, which will be the most, like Governor's Palace is made of brick, which would really is kind of the divider between rich and poor, is the difference between brick and wood. The vast majority of the structures in Williamsburg, though, are made of wood or clapboard. But even though in England there would be no such thing as a wooden Georgian structure, in Williamsburg, in order to let everyone kind of participate in this new style, there was a local style that developed, wooden, very simple wooden Georgian architecture. One of the things that happened to Williamsburg is after 1780, after the Revolution, the capital of Virginia was moved to Richmond, and the city, for all intents and purposes, died completely, almost completely. It was just a tiny little village afterwards, one thing that is kind of typical of the South in particular is this, you know, I painted this picture of this overall urbanization formula in late 18th century America. One exception is the South. There are only a few places where cities really in this period, where towns really were becoming cities. Williamsburg's kind of a great failure that way. It had potential, but you took away its political capital and it had nothing there. It didn't have an economic engine to it. It was not a port. The political center was moved away before the Industrial Revolution, so there was no industry there. The exceptional cities, which actually deserve the name, are basically Charleston and New Orleans. This time, we'll talk about New Orleans next. New Orleans obviously started off as a town and administrative center of the French colony of Louisiana. It was taken over by Spain, though, in 1765 because of some complicated wars and political maneuvers happening in Europe. It remained under the Spanish up until a couple of years before the Louisiana Purchase that Jefferson coordinated that was finalized in 1804.
What year would you say that it was taken over by Spain?
1765. The French colony really starts around 1699. There were a lot of French traders moving through the area before then. It kind of officially started in 1699 when there really starts to be a French military presence in the region. The city is established, you don't need all these dates, but the city is established around 1718, remains under French control until 1765, then goes to the Spanish and remains in the Spanish for another basically a couple of generations. Louisiana Purchase of 1805. So basically, it's under the Spanish during this time period of the 18th century. And New Orleans was always an important port, basically from its beginning, for illicit trade between the Caribbean colonies, going to Mexico, on up the Mississippi into Canada, for the French concerns, as well as Spanish colonial. And even under the Americans, a little later, it became very important for the transport of Midwestern produce. And New Orleans actually is still the second largest port in the United States because of the combination of ocean access as well as controlling the outlet of Mississippi. So this was its real economic base. That was the first one and continues to be the most important one. However, in this period, in the 1790s, an interesting thing happened in an island called Saint-Domingue. Anyone want to explain that? You know what happened in Saint-Domingue in the 1790s? Saint-Domingue? Well, it's now known as Haiti, which is its revolutionary name. I'm just saying Saint with the French pronunciation. This is its French pre-revolutionary name, Saint-Domingue. What happened in the 1790s? Yeah, the slaves revolted and took over the entire island. And as a result, there was an exodus of French elite, free people of color, as well as some slaves. And a large number of them ended up in New Orleans. And the economy of Saint-Domingue was fueled by sugar, which was extremely profitable. Very valued precious commodity in Europe. But there are very few places that it would grow. It doesn't really grow much of any place in Europe. A few parts of Spain is about it. So when these people came to Louisiana in the 1790s, they had the know-how to produce sugar profitably. People had tried in Louisiana before, but really it didn't take off. As a result of particularly the knowledge that imported slaves brought, because they were really the ones who understood the day-to-day operations, how to grow the cane, how it needs to be tended, how to process it. It was their kind of technological know-how that created a kind of agricultural revolution in Louisiana that led it to be, by the antebellum period, the
is the wealthiest slave state in the world. And ironically, it was a direct result of the slave revolt in Haiti. It's one of those things about history. One of the things in terms of other aspects of material culture in this period that's really interesting is that if you've ever been to the French Quarter, you know what those buildings look like, right? They're brick townhouses with lots of iron balconies. Tall, interior walls and doors and windows, as well as some cottages in smaller styles. The cottages, probably like the Chapman House, were influenced by Haitian architecture, but also some French Caribbean styles. However, the majority of the houses in the French Quarter aren't French at all. They're Spanish. The city burned down to the ground in 1788, and when it was rebuilt, the Spanish decided they didn't want to go through that again, so they established all these building codes that said the structures had to be of brick, they had to have firewalls, they had to be so tall, they had to have tile roofs rather than cypress shingle roofs.
What year did it burn down?
1788.
What year was that church built in New Orleans? I think it's the French Quarter, right?
Yeah, St. Louis Cathedral. There was a church on that site from the beginning in 1718. That structure that you see there is the third structure.
It's built on top of it or something?
Built one right on top of the other. So that one dates to after the fire. I think it's 1719.
What was the fire from?
The rumor is it was a candle in a kind of devotional corner of someone's house that fell over. I'm trying to remember what day it was. It was on a special day in the Catholic calendar, and someone just was
setting
the candle.
So there's some candle.
Yeah. So, but as a result, what's really interesting is that the architecture of the quote-unquote French Quarter, which local residents will still interpret as French, was actually Spanish through this one, you know, kind of accident, A, the fire, and B, through the Spanish building codes. And so one of the things that's interesting that we might talk about a little later is how the kind of cultural memory of the physical environment jives or doesn't jive with what actually happened. I think this really gets connects to, in part, that first Yench article that we talked about last week, and how she was talking about the folk mythologies that build up about houses and what's remembered is what the contemporary community thinks is important, but isn't necessarily based in historical reality. In the French Quarter is another really good example, that it became really important for the community to remember its French heritage. It was not so important to remember the Spanish heritage. So as a result, that kind of folk history of French Quarter architecture has been really clouded over. Another way it has is through food. Anyone know about jambalaya? What's jambalaya? How do you make jambalaya?
Yeah. And rice.
Yeah. There are African influences definitely in jambalaya, but there wasn't any rice in Louisiana until the Spanish arrived. Not a whole lot of it. And it looks a heck of a lot like a paella. Anyone have the Spanish dish paella? It's indistinguishable, except that Louisiana's put a lot of hot sauce in their paella. Basically is paella. So that's another thing that's classically kind of Louisiana material culture. It's a contribution from the Spanish, but that Spanish heritage, for whatever reason, that I'm still interested in figuring out myself, I don't have a real clear answer, has been forgotten in the collective folk memory. Yeah, I think part of it is that there was actually a revolution against the Spanish when they tried to take over it. It failed, and a lot of people lost their heads over it. So there was some animosity between the Spanish administrators and the French populace. But that, after generations, so actually calmed down, and the Spanish were integrated into the French Creole culture.
Not only that, but just from the dates it was French for almost 100 years and only Spanish before it.
Yeah, although the city itself, if you're just talking about New Orleans, really starts in 1718, so it's about equal. Is it 1718 to 1765, 1765 to 1805?
So 1699.
1699 is when the whole territory of Louisiana starts to be settled. The city doesn't start until 1718. And then it's just a little hamlet of huts in the mud. The other thing about New Orleans architecture and some changes that occurred there is that the French, you know, we know about this architecture only archaeologically because there are no, there's one standing example that I excavated, but I disagree with architectural historians about how old the structure actually is. It's called Madame John's Legacy. If you're ever a tourist in New Orleans or want to check it out, it's in the French Quarter. If you go and look at it, it gives you the clearest idea of what houses in the French colonial earlier period actually looked like, and they're radically different from the Spanish architecture. But one thing that they incorporated that French architecture did not have, and this was an example of an adaptation to the environment that colonists had to make, was building a house basically around a courtyard. An open air room is basically how they used it and what they called it. And you can imagine Louisiana has, you know, temperatures in the 90s and 90% humidity for 4 or 5 months out of the year. You really just don't want to be indoors. And the houses are built such to get as maximum ventilation as they can, especially the breeze coming off the river. But when it's that hot, even that doesn't help. So a lot of activities in the summer occurred outside. So one of the very quickest adaptations to the environment that occurred architecturally was to start using outdoor space in a different way. And part of the idea of this, just like we talked about the idea of porches coming from Africa, the courtyard tradition may have also been an idea influenced by Louisiana's early African pioneers. Moving on to my final city example is New York. And you may be surprised to learn that it was the second city of late 18th century America. It was quite a bit smaller than Philadelphia. In 1770, it only had 23,000 people. Its growth, like New Orleans, was also driven by river and ocean trade. It is the port. And after the Revolution, that's when it really started to grow. And it's a great period of expansion, though it doesn't actually happen until later. After the Erie Canal goes in 1825, which connects it to the interior markets of the Great Lakes area and Midwest and upper upstate New York. And it was only then that New York became a major center of commodity exchange, banking, marine insurance, and manufacturing, basically a center of capitalism. Was kind of the brain center, the nervous system center of the American Industrial Revolution. Immigrants, particularly Irish, German, Jewish, and Italian, began to arrive in large numbers in this early 19th century. I'm moving kind of quickly here since it wasn't much of a town to talk about in the late 18th. We're kind of looking forward to some of the articles we talk about really dealing with the immigrant experience in the antebellum period. Between 1820 and 1840, the city's population more than doubled. And 10 years later, in 1850, it had doubled again. It was a tremendous rate of growth. Now, in terms of an example of material culture, what's really interesting to consider about New York this time, there are a lot of things, and we'll be reading some articles that deal with really specific domestic space in New York in the mid-19th century. But one thing to consider is how the landscape of New York changed. Basically, it started off as a kind a hodgepodge town, slowly growing town. We just get people creating new streets and houses wherever they needed to go, where the ground wasn't too marshy. So it had kind of a fingery, funny, disorganized town layout. But around the time of the revolution, you start getting a real adaptation of town planning and grids, a gridded street system being imposed in cities across the colonies. This was happening in Europe a little earlier, but there didn't seem to really be a need for it in America, or a kind of cultural value attached to a real well-organized town plan until the revolutionary era. It's what the architectural historian I mentioned before, Del Upton, what he calls the Republican city in terms of Republican values, a well-ordered cityscape influenced by Enlightenment thinking that everything should be clear and understandable and natural, everything in its place. And this is similar to the Georgian mindset. It might be another extension of the Georgian mindset. Really, the Georgian mindset is kind of a British and American version of this Enlightenment culture, generally, that's coming out of Europe and intellectual movements in Europe. So by the 1820s in New York, one way that they were dealing with this influx of population was actually by tearing down parts of the town and rebuilding in a well-ordered grid, the streets intersecting at 90-degree angles. And part of what this allowed is it allowed you to assign different areas to the poor and the rich. They were no longer living side by side, cheek by jowl. There started to grow neighborhoods in New York with distinct ethnic and class identities. People became uncomfortable. It didn't used to be a problem, but people started to become uncomfortable living next to people of different colors, ethnicities, different economic levels. Not across the board. From a general trend, where the cityscape itself, the landscape itself, starts to get stratified and reflects that general trend in social stratification that started to occur in the late 18th century. The other thing that's occurring is this kind of segregation of commercial and domestic space, where you don't manufacture, you don't shop, you don't shod a horse on the same street in which genteel people live. There start to be commercial streets and neighborhoods divided off. And buildings themselves, it used to be quite common in the 18th century for people to, middle class people to build a structure where the lower part of the structure was for their business, whether they were a doctor, a grocer, a pharmacist, even a brewer. You can imagine there's quite some smells coming out of a brewery. And then upstairs would be your family's residence. Well, that kind of architecture really started to go by the wayside at this time. And this kind of reorganization of the urban landscape gradually took over other cities, and to the extent that when you started getting new Western cities built, like Cincinnati, they were built from the ground up on this grid system, and as a result evolved very differently and very rapidly. It also really promoted rapid growth. All you'd have to do is keep extending grid lines. It's very easy to do. Okay, that's it for my spiel on urbanization around the turn of the 18th century. Any questions? Last thing I want to do before we turn to the readings, this shouldn't take too long, is that I've realized that there's some archaeological vocabulary that's being thrown at you in these articles that I expect might be going over your head, but only one person really emailed me saying that they don't understand X, and I would like to encourage you to, as you keep going through, some of these readings are written for a general audience. Many of them are written for specialists in the field, so they're going to assume a level of knowledge and comfort with you would like to go through. One that keeps recurring is actually some words invented in 1965 by Lewis Binford, archaeologist out of Michigan we talked about before, who really is considered the daddy of processual archaeology. And he wrote an article in which he tried to really break down the different functions of artifacts. We're going to take a functional analysis. Have you guys seen authors use this? Technomic? Sociotechnic? And video. Okay. And we can remember, I guess. You guys come across these in your meetings? It's come up a couple of times. Technomic, they're basically what they sound like. What he tried to do is to say that artifacts can be classified into these three basic types of functional categories. So technomic artifacts are tools that primarily function to cope with the physical environment. Tools that function primarily to cope with the physical environment. And their variability is largely explainable, according to Binford, in ecological terms. In other words, you ought to be able to explain why the ZZ culture uses flint spearheads, whereas the Lulu culture uses only granite spears or something. Does that make sense? But anyway, that it should be explainable by the different ecological conditions pertaining to those two cultures. All right. Sociotechnic are artifacts that function primarily in the social system. Very transparent. They have a social function. Idiotechnic. Artifacts reflect most clearly the mental or cognitive component of art, and that's their main purpose, to communicate ideas. So some historical examples of these might be a technomic artifact might be a hunting rifle. It's primarily used as a tool to deal with the environment. A sociotechnic might be a petticoat used in women's dress. It mainly has a social aspect, i.e. to communicate femininity. It has some, we'll talk about this, some technomic function too, to keep you warm. But since women continue to wear thick petticoats, even in very hot weather, it had to have some other function besides ecological. And an idiotechnic historic artifact might be a rosary, a set of rosary beads, mainly communicates religious ideas that's involved, significance for its user. Now, the main problem, as I've kind of hinted already, with this typology is that you can have one artifact do all three things. Anyone think of an example? Candles? That actually was one used in reading, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What did they say? Who was it that did that? I can't remember. Was it Dietz? Yeah. I think it might have been Dietz, the first Dietz reading. What did he say?
Well, it was the thing that you could use it to light your house.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I forget the social function of it.
Candlelit dinner, I think.
People
yeah,
gather around
a,
it.
Was that it?
People gather around it.
Yeah.
A social function.
To create an atmosphere, even for romance or entertainment, just to facilitate social interactions. Uh-huh. And what was the third?
Church.
Mm-hmm. Like a prayer candle?
Mm-hmm.
Signify prayer. So these are useful things to think about, but don't ever, like if you're using these ideas in your research projects, don't get in the habit of thinking that your artifact type only serves one function. It might actually be a really good challenge to think about, like a hunting rifle. Its technomic aspect is quite clear, but what can you do to identify its socio-technical, neo-technical? Does it have those functions? What might they be? They may not be as obvious, but they might be there. And that might be a good way to spur your analysis. Okay, other simple vocabulary, much of which I expect you know. Some of this is vocabulary, and some of this is like the toolkits of historical archaeologists. I just want to make sure you understand. Stratigraphy, I think we've talked about this. Anyone want to just define stratigraphy for me?
It's like the levels of the archaeological site, that which is below is older than that which is above.
Okay. It's the layers in the ground. And feature. Deposition or a living surface, or people have been living for a long time and things have accumulated, that's a kind of feature. A trash pit has created a hole in the ground, is a feature. A trench for a building foundation is a feature. If you have some of the foundation itself, that's a feature. If you have a stain in the ground where you had a rotted piece of wood from one of those earth-fast buildings, for example, that would be a feature. Context, very generic word, but when archaeologists use context, it can mean two things. They either mean its excavation context, what they call the archaeological context, which means where was an artifact found in the strata, in the layers of the ground. They think they're different strata. What was the context was it found in? Was this 1676 coin found in a 19th century level? Is that its context? Then what does that mean? Other context is obviously cultural context, historical context. If this coin was found in the archaeological context of a 19th century layer, what does that mean culturally and historically? Was it a charm? Was it an heirloom? These are more specific types of features. Midden. What's midden?
Your trash pit. Your trash, like, pile.
Yeah.
Corner of the cave or whatever it is.
Yeah. A trash deposit. It can be a layer. It can be in a pit. It can be a pile. It doesn't really matter. It means a archaeological feature that was gradually, usually gradually, yeah. It's midden, it's gradual. A gradual accumulation of trash. As opposed to a trash deposit, which could have, that's a more generic term, could have been done very quickly, as in Dietz's discoveries at Flower Dew of those huge trash deposits that look like they happened in a weekend. Okay, but midden is a gradual accumulation. Sheet refuse. And also, midden usually has the implication that there's a lot of organic material, food remains, biological remains. You know what that is. Sheet refuse. This is more used in historical. Midden's used prehistorically as well as historically. Sheet refuse is a little more common for historical archaeologists to talk about. It's a little more visible in historical periods. There are some definitions in the reading. Anyone want to take a stab at it?
I don't know. People just kind of like throw their their trash out instead of putting it in the most visible place, so it just kind of covered everything?
Yeah, kind of a blanket distribution of accidental trash as opposed to intentional trash deposits, which are midden would be. I guarantee you that wherever you live, and unless your backyard or front yard has been recently graded and filled in, that if you were to do a little archaeological dig, you would find a button here, the tag of a Coke can there, maybe a few bones. Not very dense, but kind of scattered around, accidentally dropped, you know, on your way to taking the trash to the can, the bottom fell out and some stuff fell down, things like that. That's sheet refuse. Okay, it's scattered around the yard. And it has to do with, usually a yard, it can be a living surface as well. It's very thin. But particularly in cases where you're on a site where the trash has been removed, particularly in the historical era or an urban context, trash has been removed off-site because it's smelly. Accumulates too much in a dense urban space, sheet refuse might be your only archaeological context other than architectural features. Okay. Going on to the toolkits, what about mean ceramic dating? We talked about these a little bit, they're getting used so much in the articles, I really want you to have a firm idea of what they mean. You don't need to know how to do it necessarily. Understand what they're talking about when people say, well, we perform this kind of analysis on the ceramics. And what does this mean?
So that when you have, you count how many pieces of which types of ceramics you have, and then you find out the percentages and compare that to what you know of different ceramics.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah. You take a sure count, you figure out where the peak is, and you average things out, and you end up with a date that should be the midpoint of occupation for whatever context you're analyzing. And usually you would perform this, if you were a good archaeologist, you would only perform this on one level at a time, one stratigraphic layer, or one feature. Sometimes they lump them all together, which is okay if you have a short occupied site that's built up really quickly, it's only been occupied for 20 years, you might get an accurate date. But if your site's been occupied for 200 years, and you try to do mean ceramic dating on it, you'll get a date that won't make a whole lot of sense. Because as we go through time, what happens with ceramics and general material groups? Thinking from the 17th century forward? What? Right, the older they are, the less likely they preserve. But also, for the later types from the Industrial Revolution forward, from the 1920s forward, you get a huge general increase in the number of ceramics and material goods that people have in their houses. So that if you average those numbers out, you're going to get a falsely late date. So since people just have more stuff later you go on time. So that's one caveat really in mind. Ceramic price indexing. This is really important. We'll continue to read references to it when we get into class analysis. It also came up in the readings for this week. What is it? How do you do it?
You know how much each of the different kinds of pottery are worth, so you can tell kind of the economic status of that, whoever occupied that site.
Right. Very similar to mean ceramic dating, the way you apply it, you need to apply it to a very discrete context. You take only the ceramics from one level, hopefully no more than about 20 years, about about a half a generation. And you total all the shared counts, put them into the different types, pre-medical, pearlware, porcelain, whatever. And then you look up in these tables that are actually based on manufacturers' price guides. You know, recommended retail, what do you call that? Yes, exactly. There were lists for those that the English potteries that were creating the majority of the ceramics put out in the 18th century and early 19th century. And so this archaeologist found these lists buried in the archives and just said, hey, look, now we know how much people are paying for the goods. He you need to apply it in as careful a way as you do the means of digging, because if you apply it to too large a span, you're not going to know that it makes any sense. And the way they calculate it is they make creamware number one. It's worth one, it's arbitrary. It would be worth one penny, $1. It doesn't matter. But then everything's in relationship to one for that time period. Does that make sense? So it's a way to figure out how you can compare sites, how much people were paying for ceramics, how much money went into their ceramics. It may not tell you a whole lot about economic status if that was an important form of display of economic status. You understand what I'm saying?
How much did ceramics cost in comparison to maybe a week's salary?
That's a really good question. I mean, you'd have to ask that question really specifically, like say for one of those Philadelphia laborers, and you pin it down to an exact year. In one of the articles, I believe it's the Yench article, she talks about how laborers couldn't afford creamware when it was really at its peak amongst the elites. But 20 years later, because they'd become outmoded, they could. I would say for most of the time period prior to the Civil War, most laborer class people could not afford new fashionable ceramics. They'd be purchasing used or at least outmoded styles. Okay. Three more. Institute. Another term people underline is usually italicized. This is Latin. They'll use this all the time.
Where it's from, like without having it been disturbed, like by the people that are excavating it or whatever, so
right.
You can study it in situ, like where it's found from.
Okay. In place, it means really. So if you're studying a house foundation in situ, it means that as you've excavated, you've revealed the house foundation and you're leaving it there, you're not going to pull it up as you excavate. One of the things you need to realize about excavations is that by and large, archaeologists destroy what they're interested in studying as they go layer by layer. If I remove this 20th century layer, and I might remove it with a trowel and put it in a screen and get all the dirt out, pull out all the artifacts, but once I've pulled it up, it's gone. I can never look at it again. But if I find a brick foundation here, I can either remove the bricks as I'm going, one layer at a time, or I can leave it in situ. Remember we talked about pedestaling, that neat technique that we talked about? That was a way of leaving things in situ. It was leaving them in relationship to where they were found in the ground. All right. And two more that you guys probably already know. Well, we already talked about these, but you might as well keep them clear. Terminus post quem. Artifact telling you about the date of a context, of a feature, of a strata. So you use an artifact to tell you one of these two things. So it would be an example of an artifact that can give me a terminus postquem date. It gives you a date to what it does. Meaning that literally, terminus postquem means it has to have ended after this. What is the this? The context. The context, whatever that is archaeologically, a layer, a feature, foundation, it has to be older than this. You want to think of an example? Mm-hmm. More specifically, or?
Well, you could like look at the style of ceramic and then you would know the date, but like the decade or whatever that was, you know, popular or whatever.
Whether at first, what you want to do for terminus postquem is not look at popularity, which is what you look at for mean ceramic dating. You look at the earliest time that it was created, when it first showed up on the scene, it was first manufactured. So underneath this foundation, I find a shirt of creamware, which is usually abbreviated CC. Creamware really
first record of it being manufactured is 1762. So that's buried directly beneath the last row of bricks of my foundation here. So what does that mean about that, the structure of this foundation? It has to be laid out in 1762. Doesn't mean that the structure was built in 1762. It could have been built in 1920, but we at least know it doesn't go earlier than that. Okay. So terminus antiquum is a little less common. Can you think of it as a way in which you get, say, that same shirt or a coin or something, where you would get an indication that something had to be before? Use example of the Grip Foundation. What could you find in association with the Grip Foundation that would give you a final end date? That this, say, well, I don't put a date on it, depending on what your example is, but it tells you that that building had to have been constructed before X date.
Material that was no longer used or that you couldn't find anymore after that day?
Yeah, that's a possibility. You might want, that is a very good possibility. Say, bricks imported from England, and say that you know that bricks were never imported in from England anymore after 1870. Then you could say, well, that structure was probably, now in this case you can't be as sure, because what happens with brick? You get reused. So that one, you'd need some other thing. A better example might be, see this one here? This is actually an asphalt parking lot that when I went into the city records, I found that it was paved over in 1920. Well, that's kind of early for an asphalt parking lot, say 1930. So I now have this wonderful dating. I think I'm running here. I know that the structure was built sometime between 1762 and 1930 when it was capped and covered over.